Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to coast, This Week in America. Great to have you with us on the program. January 8th, 2015, the United States Olympic Committee designated Boston as its choice to host the 2024 Summer Games. And for a time, it seemed inevitable that the International Olympic Committee would choose Boston to host those games. After many promises, the financial details of the bid became public. Citizens asked tough questions. Trust me was no longer a good enough answer. The new book, No Boston Olympics, How and Why Smart Cities Are Passing on the Torch, is the behind-the-scenes play-by-play account of how an underfunded opposition group, No Boston Olympics, and other allied agencies and Massachusetts residents rejected the games, changed the course of Boston's history. Co-authors are Chris Dempsey and Andrew Zimbalist, both at ground zero of the debate. Chris was a co-founder and leader of No Boston Olympics. Andrew, a respected and acclaimed world expert on the economics of sports, a leading researcher on the hidden cost of holding mega events such as Olympics and World Cup. He's the Robert A. Wood Professor of Economics at Smith College, the author of over 20 books, including Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and World Cup, as well as numerous articles and essays. And Andrew Zimbalist, called by PBS's Wall Street Week and Fortune as the country's leading sports economist and co-author of No Boston Olympics, How and Why Smart Cities Are Passing on the Torch, is with us on This Week in America. Andrew, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
This is such a fascinating book, and it's really interesting how a bid to host an Olympic game actually develops. Boston 24 was the private group that organized the Boston bid for the 2024 games. Who were those people?
Well, the head of the group, by no small coincidence, was a man by the name of John Fish, who was the owner and CEO of the largest construction company in New England called Suffolk Construction. And, of course, when you host the Olympics, there are billions and billions of dollars of construction contracts that get doled out. So, inevitably, you have at the forefront of these efforts construction executives. And they're usually backed, of course, by the trade unions, the construction trade unions. But there are other individuals, other executives from the hospitality industry, from the insurance industry, maybe from some of the investment banks that will probably be floating the bonds to help pay for the construction up front. So you have a group of well-known, usually very prominent individuals in the community who then go to the case of Boston, then went to Marty Walsh, the mayor, and got Marty Walsh to sign on to the plan. So Boston 2024 was a group of private individuals. They were acting on their own initiative. They never went to the Boston City Council to either have a discussion or to have a vote endorsing the Boston bid. Same thing with the state legislature. They had no role whatsoever. So this private group of individuals appropriated the name of Boston and implicated Boston in all of these commitments, because once they got Marty Walsh to sign on, the mayor, he signed the joinder agreement with what's called the joinder agreement with the United States Olympic Committee, and that obligated the city of Boston to do everything basically that the IOC to do, and that included assuming the financial responsibility for any cost overruns or revenue shortfalls. And every Olympic game since 1960 that we have record cost overruns. Since 1980, the average cost overrun has been 3.5 times the initial bid. And Boston was basically committing itself to take on all of that inevitably was going to happen. Another thing that Marty Walsh signed in the joint agreement was something that was called the gag rule. What it said was that any employee of the city of Boston that said anything critical of the Boston bid or of the USOC or of the IOC would be disciplined for that. They weren't allowed the right of free speech anymore. So it went on and on like this, and I think that was one of the things that enabled the No people, the No Boston Olympic group, to be able to approach the media with sensible arguments and eventually to penetrate the public opinion to the extent that which was all majority support beginning of the Boston bid, to a situation where only about 30% of the people were supporting it by the time the bid was pulled in late July of 2015.
Now, just a couple days after you received the bid, the U.S. bid to host the games, there's a meeting in a church. The group pays like $700 for a sanctuary in an old Boston neighborhood for everybody to get together. You were the featured speaker that day. Tell me a little bit about that and what you told these people, because you had some good people there that were concerned that maybe we're going into this too quickly.
Yeah, so, you know, basically to host the Summer Olympics these days, you're looking at, for most cities, you're looking at an expense on the order of $15 to $20 billion. You have to build 36 Olympic sporting venues. You have to build an Olympic village. That's probably a $3 billion expense because you need to house 15,000 to 16,000 athletes and coaches and trainers. You need to build an international broadcasting and media center, which could be another $1 billion expense. You need to do an immense amount of infrastructural work, transportation, connections between the different venues, special lanes for the IOC executives. You need to clear all the billboards in your town and make them available for the IOC sponsors from a month before the games to a month after the games. The list goes on and on. So there's a lot of expenditures, and you're also speaking about somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 acres of land that ultimately have to get dedicated to all of this activity that the IOC demands. So for a city like Boston that's relatively packed geographically, that's an enormous imposition, and it means basically you have to push some people out. We saw that most recently, of course, in Rio, where they kicked out 77,200 favelados, poor people who lived in these shanty towns. They just kicked them out in order to make room for the venues and the transportation routes. So it's a big deal, and that's what I was talking about. I said, you know, on the one side, you're looking at an expense, $15 to $20 billion, plus an enormous amount of disruption to your city. On the positive side, you're looking at maybe $4 billion, give or take, for revenues. So your costs are to three times your revenues, roughly, four times your revenues. And the IOC likes to say, well, in the long run, you get your money back because you'll be promoting tourism and promoting foreign trade and investment. Those are nice sentiments, but they're not borne out empirically by the experience of recent Olympic hosts.
Well, they're probably not.
It's not a good deal in the typical case.
And usually they throw those arguments out, and you had your analytics together. You were able to say, no, that's not the case. And to say this was David versus Goliath is an understatement. They've got, at the time you're meeting in Boston, they've got like $10 million, and the opposition group, No Boston Olympics, has like less than $5,000 in the bank account. Yet you were able to prevail. And what, 200 days later, the bid is terminated. What was that like, and what are the long-term repercussions? Because you upset a number of people in Boston, the officials that called you obstructionist.
Well, that's right. But I don't think any of us that were involved suffered in our reputation. I think that there's been a recognition that we did a good deed for Boston. At the end of it all, after the USOC pulled the bid from Boston, John Fish actually called up my co-author, Chris Dempsey, and said democracy worked. And I think that's the main lesson that people in Boston took. I mean, Boston has a very proud history. I think many people in Boston think of Boston as the cradle of U.S. democracy. It has a very vibrant press. The press was very interested in carrying both sides of this issue. The No Boston 2024 group was able to take advantage of social media, which, of course, is a new tool that enables that kind of mass communication very effectively. So we had a lot of stuff going for us, and I think that if we've learned the lesson in Boston, and by the way, Chris and I have also been in touch after the Boston bid was rejected. We were in touch with people in Toronto who were contemplating a bid. We were invited, both of us independently, to Hamburg, and we talked to people in Budapest and Rome, and all those cities ultimately rejected a bid also. So it's a lot of people who are thinking like this, but hopefully, in my mind, The one thing that I want Boston to take away from this is the importance of democracy, and it's the importance of involving people in the community, in the planning for that community. You shouldn't be planning a community based upon the needs of an international sporting organization. That's not what Boston's top priorities are. Boston, like most cities, needs better health care. They need better transportation. They need better public schools. Those are things that should be the priorities for a city. And if you involve the people in discussions about the city's future, I think those are the things that will rise to the top, not hosting a 17-day party for the International Olympic Committee.
Well, and you're talking about the ramifications of what you did, and the reason for the book is much greater than just hosting an Olympic game, because a lot of cities will never even be considered for that, but sort of planning long-term where we go as a region and who ends up paying for everything as we go in that direction.
Well, that's something, where we go is something that I shouldn't determine. It should be determined on the basis of popular discussion and,
yes.
and a lot of forethought. And I think in terms of urban planning, each city is a little bit different. But in my own personal view, I think one of the things we clearly need is more mass transportation. We need clearly to deal with climate change and pollution that emanates from our homes and our schools and our factories. We need lots of things that should be determined by the people in those cities, not by a set of executives in a particular sector in the economy, in the urban economy, not by the mayor, but popularly through our democratically elected representatives and in referendums and other vehicles.
Now, it's interesting, a couple of minutes left in the program, we're talking about the new book, No Boston Olympics, How and Why Smart Cities Are Passing on the Torch. With us, the co-author, Andrew Zimbalist. Let's talk about the IOC. Did they learn any lessons from this? You go back to the start of the modern Olympics back like in 1896, and they had problems back then, and they were criticized for the way they were doing business. Did they learn anything by being basically rejected by Boston?
I think the IOC realizes that it's in a crisis period right now. Their new leader, Thomas Bach, got the IOC to pass something called Agenda 2020 in December of 2014. It was basically window dressing, but it was at the same time implicitly an acknowledgement that hosting the Olympics had become too expensive and not economically viable, and it become detrimental ecologically. And that they needed to make changes, and so they did. They pronounced a renewed commitment to more democracy and to more concern about the environment and to more financial sustainability. They pronounced those commitments, but the amount of change has been really very small. And so Thomas Bach these days is talking about the need for more change, and I think one element of that change is we're going to see in September when the IOC votes on who gets to host the 2024 Games. I think what you'll see then is the IOC will choose two cities, one for 2024 and one for 2028, so it doesn't have to put itself through these embarrassing years of having city after city say to the IOC, we're not interested anymore.
A fascinating book called No Boston Olympics, How and Why Smart Cities Are Passing on the Torch, co-authored by Chris Dempsey, co-founder and leader of No Boston Olympics, and our guest on This Week in America, Andrew Zimbalist, world-renowned expert on economics of sports. Andrew, it is a pleasure to have you on the program. Excellent book. I really enjoyed reading it, having you on the program. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's very kind of you. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're listening to This Week in America online, thisweekinamerica.us.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.